You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, and welcome to the Explorers Podcast. Today is part two in our series on French explorer Jules Dumont d'Urville. Two notes for today. D'Urville is heading out on his first epic adventure, a voyage around the world, as the second-in-command of the Coquille expedition. I've put a map of the ship's route on our website, explorerspodcast.com. Check it out if you want to follow along on the journey. Second note, if you want to enter to win a copy of the book Daring French Explorations, which D'Urville is a part of, click on the link in our show notes, or you can go to the website. Alrighty, that is it for notes. Let's roll. The date was August 11, 1822. The French naval vessel, the Coquille, departed Toulon, France, fighting stiff winds as she headed into the Mediterranean Sea and towards the Strait of Gibraltar. The Coquille was a corvette-class vessel with a dozen cannons and had once been used as a transport ship. It was not large, but had been updated for the upcoming journey. The ship's contingent boasted 60 crewmen plus 12 officers. The Coquille was headed on a round-the-world journey, mainly looking to map and chart and explore the South Pacific and Australia. The commander of the expedition was Louis-Isidore Duperré. The second-in-command was our series star, Jules Dumont d'Urville. D'Urville was 32 years old, tall, robust, and with blonde hair. He had left behind a wife that he adored and a young son. Parting had not been easy. Regarding D'Urville and his commander, I mentioned last time that things were off to a rocky start even before departing. Duperré was a mercurial man, energetic and confident, and often insecure. He was sensitive to criticism and didn't like being questioned. He was known to lash out in these situations with caustic and condescending remarks. D'Urville was sensitive to slights as well and known to hold grudges, but he was Duperré's subordinate and he adjusted his attitudes accordingly for the voyage. But he would never be happy with the situation, which was hard for a man of his ego and ambition. I want to mention a few of the ship's officers. The first is Charles Jacquinot, a 26-year-old ensign who had sailed with D'Urville on the Chevrette to the Black Sea. He was described as an amiable ladies' man who liked to entertain everyone with bawdy stories. D'Urville liked the man immensely, and he would go on to be a key part of each of his expeditions. The second man was Ensign Victor Charles Lotan, age 27, and another veteran of the Chevrette. D'Urville liked and trusted both of these men. On the Chevrette, they had learned what it took to conduct a serious scientific study. It was hard and rigorous work, and he knew they would get the job done. Another officer of the Coquille was Jacques-Étienne Barrère, who had been on the Uranie expedition with Louis Freycinet. An officer assigned to the ship by the Minister of the Navy was midshipman Jules de Bloisville. Bloisville would embrace his role on the expedition, becoming an expert in hydrography. One interesting specialist was François-Louis Lejeune, an 18-year-old artist and nephew of a French general. And when I say nephew, I am actually saying illegitimate son of the general, who was also a famous painter. Lejeune would provide an important visual record of the expedition. 28-year-old René Lesson was the expedition's pharmacist. He had served as a surgeon as well as botanist on other assignments, and he would take part in many of D'Urville's natural science excursions. Lesson, by the way, would write a two-volume account of the Coquille expedition, so he is an important source for this part of our story. The final person I'll mention is Charles Lesage, who is an old friend of Duperré's. D'Urville objected to the appointment, which was done without his consultation. Lesage proved to be ill-suited for his duties and was disliked by D'Urville and many of the crew. As for the crew, it was an experienced one and included several men who had been on the Urani expedition. Their experience would be quite valuable. As for the officers, this was a big deal for many of them. In peacetime, advancement and wealth were hard to come by in the Navy, not to mention glory. Exploration offered that opportunity. The goals of the expedition were to explore and document areas of the South Pacific and Australia. This included New Guinea, the Caroline Islands, New Zealand, and the Polynesian Islands. The expedition would map and chart reefs and islands and trace routes through dangerous archipelagos. They would conduct magnetic and meteorological tests. They would collect plants, animals, and mineral samples. They would study the people, their language, their customs, and culture. One thing the French government was interested in was expanding their colonial holdings, so finding a place to establish a colony, specifically a penal colony, was on the list of things to do. New Zealand and Western Australia were prime spots for such an endeavor. The British had successfully established a penal colony on the eastern shore of Australia, so the French thought, why not set up one of their own? The Coquille departed Toulon on August 11, 1822. The ship initially struggled to make much headway due to winds and storms, but in time, she would make it through the Strait of Gibraltar and into the Atlantic Ocean. The first stop was the Canary Islands, which the ship reached in late August. The Coquille took on wine and other supplies, but no one was allowed to go ashore. And the reason for that was that there was political unrest in Spain at the time, and France was preparing to intervene with troops if necessary. This made Spanish officials on the island uneasy about letting any French personnel ashore. Derville and Lauzon would lament the missed opportunities to botanize the island. This included Tenerife and Mount Teide, which had been made famous by Alexander von Humboldt in his works. Naturalists loved nothing more than to stop and climb Teide, just as Humboldt had done. From the Canaries, it was on to the Cape Verde Islands, where Derville collected his first plant specimens, some seaweed samples, exciting, and then headed slowly across the Atlantic. Along the way, King Louis XVIII died back in France and would be followed by his brother, Charles X. Louis had been conservative, like many monarchs before him, but his brother was mega-conservative. Rule by divine right, no constitution, crack down on freedom of press, invade Algeria, more power to the church and the nobility. You get the picture. The change would not mean much for the Coquille or the expedition, but Derville would recoil from the ultra-royalist makeover of the monarchy and French society. He will play an interesting role in the abdication and exile of Charles in 1830, but that is for a later episode. The voyage across the Atlantic would turn into a celebration when the Coquille crossed the equator. The time-honored tradition of dunking equator virgins into the ocean was not just something the English embraced. The French turned the event into a party, and those who had never crossed the equator were subject to being dunked in the ocean. Derville was spared a dunking when he opted to donate to the festivities, which likely included food and/or booze. James Cook had done the exact same thing on his voyage. By the way, I mentioned British explorer James Cook, and I want to note that Derville idolized the man. He saw him as the most accomplished naval explorer in history, and he had read and reread the man's journals in anticipation of this voyage. The Coquille would reach the islands of Trinidad and Martin Vaz on October 16th, where Derville recorded the sighting of many whales. These islands are about 680 miles or 1,100 kilometers east of South America. 10 days later, they were at Santa Clara Island off Brazil's east coast, roughly between Rio de Janeiro and Buenos Aires. It was here that the French were surprised to find that Brazil had declared its independence from Portugal. The Empire of Brazil, led by Pedro I, now ruled. The Brazilians were thus a bit jumpy about European ships arriving in their ports. Were they there to restore Portuguese rule? Because of this, they limited the activity of the Coquille and her crew. They were allowed to collect firewood and water and conduct scientific work, but shore leave for the crew and food and other provisions were denied. Derville was thrilled to be able to scour the coast and the jungle, following in the footsteps of his heroes. This was the first time he had gotten to do scientific work in a tropical environment. He loved it. One note for you. The Coquille had letters from the governments of Spain, England, Portugal, and the Netherlands, essentially telling anyone they ran into to help out the French ship, as it was on a peaceful scientific mission. This would, usually, allow the Coquille to go to a foreign port and be able to acquire goods and services. Next, Duperrey elected to head south to the Falkland Islands, where he wanted to obtain food before heading around Cape Horn. The voyage there went well, and the ship anchored off East Falkland Island at Port Louis, which had been founded by Louis-Antoine de Bougainville back in 1764. The port was now abandoned, but the island was filled with wild animals, courtesy of earlier settlers, including pigs, horses, oxen, and rabbits. The Freycinet expedition had been stranded on the island back in 1820 for 4 months before being rescued. The hull of the Urani was still on the beach, half buried in the sand, a stark reminder of how dangerous these voyages could be. As there were men who had been on the Urani amongst the Coquille's ranks, they were able to provide direction to the island's best hunting and fishing grounds. The Coquille would spend 2 months in the Falklands. An observatory was established, and the island offered D'Urville an outstanding contrast to the lush forest of Brazil. There were no trees and only a few shrubs, but he came to understand just how much life was still all around him. He appreciated the ability of the local plant life to adapt to the environment. He would collect 217 species of plants, 44 of them new to science, including ferns, mosses, and lichen. D'Urville would prove to be a tireless botanist, conducting 12 lengthy excursions during his time on the island. I want to note how this really demonstrates the mission of the Coquille. These men were here to map and chart, and also to conduct observations and collect specimens and samples. You will see this sort of pattern pretty much everywhere they go. An observatory will be set up, the ship or its boats would sail around and map and chart the bays and reefs and whatever. D'Urville and his men would traipse about the land collecting plant, animal, and geological samples. The crew would gather water, food, firewood, and anything else of value. It was also during this time in the Falklands that Duperrey and D'Urville would clash. At one point, Duperrey was in a bad mood, which was not uncommon, and he snapped at D'Urville and told him that the astronomical and geographic work being done was not something he should bother with. D'Urville would acknowledge the order and never again help with that field of work. He stuck to the natural history stuff. Both of these men were stubborn and prideful. D'Urville couldn't dispute these orders, so he fought back by being extremely short with Duperrey, making their interactions awkward and uncomfortable. I mean, he always followed orders, but he made darn sure that he never did anything more than that. Another thing I want to mention is D'Urville's penchant for sloppy attire. It was said that he often looked worse than the crew. Some criticized him, saying he was too familiar with the common sailors, and him not wearing his uniform made him less of an authority figure. But D'Urville didn't seem to care. He only dressed the part of an officer if necessary. A final note, I want to stress that D'Urville wasn't just doing scientific work. He was still the second in command of the expedition. Thus, he had all the typical duties required of the position. That was a full-time job. The natural science work was an addition to all the duties required of a senior officer on a naval vessel. The Coquille departed the Falkland Islands on December 28, 1822, and reached Tierra del Fuego 10 days later. Next, they rounded Cape Horn, passing through the Strait of the Mare. It was a dangerous passage, with mountains looming on both sides. Thick fog and strong winds made the going slow, but soon the Coquille was in the Pacific and heading north up the South American coast. They reached the port of Concepcion in Chile on January 20, 1823. Here the men found that revolution and rebellion and civil war was not confined to Brazil. It had pretty much touched all of Central and South America. In Chile, the head guy, Supreme Director Bernardo O'Higgins, was overthrown by a former ally just days after the Coquille arrived. And in Peru, the ship's next stop, the locals were at war with the Spanish crown. The expedition thus had to tread carefully wherever they went. Some of these regimes, such as the one led by Ramon Freire in Chile, were extremely conservative and welcomed the French as brothers of the same cloth. Others, such as in Peru, were wary, wondering if the French were working with the Spanish in some fashion. No matter, the ship would go from Concepcion to Callao, Peru, and then Paita, also in Peru. Each time they took on supplies and food when possible, but they did not linger to avoid getting entangled in local affairs. However, D'Urville would go out and do field work when possible, which nearly ended in disaster in Callao. When he was there, he was out collecting specimens in the countryside and was arrested as a spy. He was lucky he was not shot on sight. He was ultimately released, but not before his watch and money were stolen. The Coquille departed from Peru on March 22nd. The ship made observations as it crossed the magnetic equator, which it did a total of 6 times. The magnetic equator had only been discovered 2 decades earlier by Alexander von Humboldt. After that, it was off into the Pacific Ocean in the wake of the legends of exploration, including Ferdinand Magellan, Louis-Antoine de Bougainville, and James Cook. D'Urville, no doubt, hoped that his name would one day be listed alongside those men. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
The Coquille would not see land for a month until sighting a low-lying atoll, today called Rieo, on the eastern edge of Polynesia. The island had a few hundred natives, some who paddled out to the Coquille in canoes. These were the first Polynesians that Derville had ever seen. Attempts to engage with the islanders were futile, as they refused to come too close. The ship thus sailed on. The Coquille would push west and arrive in Tahiti on May 3rd. This was a place of legend to many of the crew, including Derville. Just half a century earlier, men such as Cook and Bougainville had been amongst the first to come here and were greeted by throngs of friendly natives. And the men praised the beauty of the women, not to mention their willingness to have sex with them. But much had changed since the time of Cook. English missionaries had converted the Tahitian monarchs to Christianity, and the island's culture had been dramatically altered. Adultery was a sin and severely punished. If a person didn't attend church, there were harsh consequences. Derville decried the situation. The Tahitians were now jaded and often joyless. Prostitution was common, despite the arrival of Christianity. While the ship took on water, timber, and food, an observatory was set up, and Derville and his team would set out to go searching for plants and animals and other fun stuff. Derville was introduced to an islander named Oturi, who had a deep knowledge of local botany. He was an incredible help, bringing Derville all over the island to gather specimens. He was also able to help Derville as he studied the Tahitian people and their language. Derville's efforts as an ethnologist were just getting going, and he will do some outstanding work in that field. In Tahiti, Derville visited many places. He saw the forests, villages, and groves of fruit, including coconuts, mangoes, and breadfruit. In the mountainous interior, he visited pre-Christian religious sites called Mare. The expedition spent 3 weeks in Tahiti, and it was an amazing experience for the naturalists and scientists. The ship's artist, François-Louis Lejeune, made some wonderful sketches of the tropical paradise. Derville demonstrated boundless energy, trekking through the island in the tropical heat. He put many of his younger colleagues to shame with his stamina. By the way, Derville had purchased a straw hat in Chile, and he wore it constantly going forward. It made him look even less like an officer. The Coquille departed Tahiti on May 22nd, bound for Bora Bora. A few quick notes. First, Derville and the rest of the scientific team would struggle to preserve many of the specimens they collected, especially plant samples. These were typically pressed between sheets of paper, but in the heat and humidity, they often got moldy and decayed. It was a problem that would dog the expedition the entire time. Second, what we saw regarding the procedures of the expedition in the Falklands and Tahiti is, as I have said, a routine that will carry over pretty much everywhere the ship will go. With that in mind, I'm not going to repeat these same things at every location that we reach. Just know that if the expedition has time, they will do all the typical things we discussed. Collect food, water, and timber. Collect meteorological and astronomical data. Go out and collect plant, animal, and geological samples. And study the native people, their culture, and their language. Third note is that the rift between Derville and Duperrey would continue. There is an example where Duperrey invited Derville to dinner. The latter arrived and then proceeded to barely speak a word to his commander the entire awkward meal. It was this passive-aggressive thing that Derville employed with people that he had trouble with. As I've said, Duperrey could alienate many of his fellow officers, but the same was true for Derville. He just wasn't that likable of a guy, and he often found petty reasons for holding a grudge. One thing that bothered him was that he felt that many of the officers treated him more like a colleague rather than a superior officer. It was, he felt, disrespectful. Yet some of this was Derville's own doing. His lack of formality, including his dress, contributed to this. Anyhow, the expedition arrived in Bora Bora, where they would stay for 6 weeks. The ship circumnavigated and charted the island, while Derville and his men did all the typical science-related stuff. Next, it was on to Tongatapu, but strong winds prevented the ship from landing. The Coquille would thus continue west and sighted New Guinea on September 6th. The ship traded with the local people wherever they could, but food was running low. With that in mind, Duperrey headed west to the Dutch-controlled Maluku Islands. Remember, the expedition had a letter from the Dutch crown ordering these ports to aid the Coquille as needed. The Dutch usually didn't welcome foreign ships in these waters to protect the lucrative spice trade. The ship stopped first in Kajili and then sailed on to Ambon. Dutch officials were helpful once they read the letter from the government. A few things to make note of at this point in our journey. First, food was running low and Dutch colonial officials, while cooperative, were not able to reprovision the Coquille as much as Duperrey needed. Second, the crew of the Coquille was struggling after a year at sea with illness and fatigue. Cholera claimed the lives of 2 men, and 4 others would desert in Ambon. The deserters were captured by the Dutch and returned to the Coquille and given 20 lashes for their efforts. Third, the ship would take on some unwanted travelers in Ambon. No, not rats. I bet you thought it was going to be rats. No, instead, it was cockroaches, and they were horrible. They infested the ship. They got into the food and water. They ate the furniture, the supplies, the hull, everything. They were so bad, Derville would sleep on the deck of the ship rather than his cabin. Even in the rain, he did this. It made for some uncomfortable days. And fourth, the next step in the expedition was to go to Western Australia. Duperrey had orders to investigate the area around the Swan River estuary, where modern-day Perth is located, as a place for a possible French settlement and or penal colony. He was to do an extensive survey of the river, look for locations to construct homes and buildings, and to identify places to plant crops and graze sheep and cattle. The Coquille would reach Australia and the Swan River, and Duperrey elected to move on after only a cursory glance at the area. He was due in Port Jackson, which is modern-day Sydney, on the other side of the continent, in January of 1824. A full-blown survey of the Swan River estuary would take a month or more. If he did the survey, he would be late. But just as important, if not more so, was the fact that food was short and there was no promise the ship would be able to obtain more from the area's indigenous people. Thus, Duperrey passed on the survey and continued east, sailing along the underbelly of Australia and reaching Port Jackson on January 17, 1824. As a note, the failure of Duperrey to complete the survey of the Swan River would be an important reason for Derville to plot its own return expedition to the area, but that is for next time. Now, as the ship neared the city, there was a dust-up between Duperrey and Ensign Charles Lesage. If you remember, Lesage was not held in high regard by Derville, or pretty much anyone on the ship. Even Duperrey, who had been the one to bring him on the expedition, came to view the man in a negative light. Anyhow, Lesage would do something to incur Duperrey's wrath, and after a bad tongue-lashing, the man snapped and unloaded verbally on his commander. This landed Lesage in the brig. Now, Derville disliked Lesage, but he disapproved of the way Duperrey had handled the situation. It was undignified to humiliate a fellow officer as such, and he felt Duperrey had lost the respect of the crew for what he had done. Duperrey would boot Lesage from the expedition, using a medical excuse to be rid of the man. And so Lesage departed the expedition once they reached Port Jackson. And in reality, it was for the best. Derville was happy to have Charles Jacquinot as his immediate subordinate. He liked and trusted Jacquinot, unlike Lesage. The city of Sydney was vibrant and growing, the population up to 35,000. Men who had been to the city just a few years earlier were shocked at how quickly the place had grown. Here, the Coquille was refitted and provisions were obtained. The English, despite the recent war with France, were helpful. While the Coquille was being worked on, Derville would visit Alan Cunningham, one of the great early figures of Australian botany. The two would become friends, bonding over their love of nature and science. A key figure in Sydney at this time was the governor of New South Wales, Sir Thomas Brisbane, or Brisbane as the Australians like to say. If you didn't figure it out, the city of Brisbane is named after the man. he welcomed the expedition with open arms. Brisbane was an astronomy fanatic, and he'd even built his own observatory. His interest in the expedition thus ensured that they would get all the provisions and aid that they needed. Deville would express interest in traveling over the Blue Mountains and into the interior of Australia. This desire was granted, and Deville, along with René Lesson, would thus be led up and over the mountains. The journey was a rugged one, as the mountains had only been crossed by Europeans for the first time a decade earlier. The road was bumpy and narrow. But the result was worth it. The two Frenchmen would get stunning views of the mountains and the interior Australian landscape. Also, there was science stuff to do. The men collected plants and animals, even obtaining a live echidna, one of only two mammals that lay eggs. The other is the platypus, also a native to Australia. Deville had hoped to see a platypus, a species that science knew almost nothing about. He would, however, be out of luck. The platypus is a nocturnal creature that shuns humans. In the interior of Australia, Deville and Lesson visited various farms and ranches. Many of these were maintained by convicts who also worked building roads. Remember, Australia had been founded as a penal colony. Deville makes some pointed comments about the penal system. He didn't like it, in particular the supposed benefits it offered the convicts once they finished their sentences. Instead of helping these people reintegrate in society, they were treated as sub-citizens. Laws and customs marginalized and discriminated against these people, preventing them from rising above their situation. And the thing that really irked Deville was that this status was passed on to their children. It was like passing on the sins and shame of their parent. René Lesson was just as critical, and he even noted the treatment of convicts and their families was going to lead to some deep social problems. Problems, he thought, that would ultimately lead to Australia becoming independent from Great Britain. Others in the fleet, however, only saw the prosperity that the penal system brought to the colony. Jules-Alphonse Bloisville would write a report praising the economic success of the colony and recommend a French penal colony be established in Western Australia or New Zealand. Anyhow, Deville and Lesson spent 15 days on the road, 12 of them sleeping under the stars. They did stop in Bathurst for several days, where Deville recovered from severe colic and nausea. By the time Deville returned to Sydney, the expedition had collected 330 types of flowering plants, including three new species, 365 birds, and boxes of other cool stuff. Much of it was shipped back to France, though three cases would be lost in a shipwreck. Also, the men of the expedition wrote letters home to their families and sent reports back to the French Naval Ministry about their progress. Now, just before departing Port Jackson, Deville would get the chance to meet the Aboriginal Australian named Bungaree. Bungaree is a minor legendary figure in Australia. He circumnavigated the continent, the first Australian to ever do so, with British explorer Matthew Flinders in the early 1800s. He was a community leader and famed in the colony for his humor and ability to mimic others, especially his impressions of past and present governors. Bungaree took Deville and others to a gathering of five or six Aboriginal tribes, each numbering 15 to 20 people. The idea was for the various groups to get together to settle feuds and hash out differences. Deville describes it all in detail. There was a big field and things were often settled by some form of combat. This included using boomerangs and clubs. This day of ritual combat resulted in only one serious injury. Deville generally takes a dim view of the Aboriginal Australians, especially when he compares them to the natives of other lands, such as the Maori in New Zealand. And speaking of New Zealand, that is the next stop for the expedition, which departed Port Jackson on March 20, 1824. For the voyage to New Zealand, the Coquille would have a few passengers. This included missionary George Clark, his wife Martha, and their infant son. But there were also two Maori men, including Tifonga, the nephew of a prominent chief, and his servant. Tifonga is an interesting character, derided by some as childish and petulant, but he was also important. He was in Australia arranging the delivery of weapons and ammunition on behalf of his uncle, Chief Hunjihika. Hunjihika dominated most of the North Island of New Zealand and was said to have been able to field an army of 1,000 warriors, all armed with muskets. A lot had changed since the days of James Cook. The Coquille sailed east across the Tasman Sea, sighting the tip of the northern island of New Zealand on March 31st. 400 Maori swam out to the ship to greet and trade with the French. The French, however, were wary of the Maori. The area had seen several disasters in the past. The crew of the British ship Boyd were ambushed in 1809. Up to 70 men were killed and then eaten. In 1772, French privateer Marc-Joseph Marion Dufresne, along with 28 of his men, were attacked and killed as well. Deville noted that the Maori were very emotional, saying, quote, They exaggerate all their sentiments and carry everything to excess, their love and devotion, as well as their hatred and vengeance. End quote. He recorded all that he could about the Maori and was impressed by many aspects of their culture, including their energetic and precision dancing. Due to the time of year, it was a bad time to collect plants, so Derville did not do a lot of botanizing. He did visit some of the local missionaries, including Thomas Kendall, or in this case, an ex-missionary. Kendall had been kicked out of the ministry after abandoning his wife and five children in favor of a Maori woman he had fallen in love with. Now he took part in the arms trade and drank too much when the whalers stopped by to visit. He was an incredible source of information on the Maori, the religion, and their language. He lived amongst them and had even written a Maori English primer. The Coquille would stay for 2 weeks before setting off to the north on April 17th. It was the start of a long voyage home, which would take 11 months. Now, it was after visiting New Zealand that Derville would begin a new project, a novel. Yes, a novel. Derville had always loved novels, and as the Coquille started its slow voyage home, he decided to spend some of his free time writing a novel. It would be called The New Zealanders, A Story of the Austral Lands. The story was about war and love and revenge, and centers around various Maori chiefs, many based on those he met in New Zealand. It is described as being written in the style of a Greek epic. I have not read the book, but reviews are generally not very good. But at least Derville avoids the noble savage tropes that fill many books of the time. It was never published in Derville's lifetime, because he didn't want it to diminish his standing as a serious writer. Fiction was seen as lowly by many. The book is the first novel ever written about native New Zealanders. The Coquille would sail north for 2 weeks and reach the island of Rotuma, which is north of Fiji. After 18 days there, they continued on and reached the Tuvalu Islands. After that, it was northeast to the Gilbert Islands. It was here that Derville noticed something about the native people. Physically, they were darker than the islanders of Tahiti or Bora Bora, and he noticed a difference in their language. He recognized these people were of different ethnic stock. He would, in time, dub them Melanesians, a term that is used to this day. Melanesia, by the way, consists of the area around New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, New Caledonia, and Vanuatu. The Gilbert Islands were right on the border between the regions of Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia. The Coquille would head west, weaving through Tarawa, the Marshall Islands, the Carolyn Islands, and eventually to New Guinea. Along the way, they stopped and traded for food when possible, and Derville would get out and botanize. As a note, Derville's frequent partner in these excursions, René Lesson, would be increasingly dogged by rheumatism. It meant that he often traveled slowly or not at all on their trips. Sadly, Derville would make a comment about this in his writings, saying Lesson was often fatigued and a, quote, sad walker, end quote. Lesson would never forgive Derville for the disparaging remarks, and when he eventually wrote his own version of the Coquille expedition, 3 years after Derville, he would not be kind. Otherwise, the expedition would map some small new islands, but mostly confirm the locations of existing places. At the island of Kosre, Derville found some people who had never been visited by Europeans. They welcomed him and his men and brought them to an impressive village of more than 800 people. Everyone was amazed at the pale skin of the newcomers. Derville gave them gifts of beads, nails, and knives. It was a unique experience of two cultures meeting for the first time. The Coquille continued west and spent 2 weeks on the Doberai Peninsula in New Guinea and then moved on to the Dutch port of Surabaya on the island of Java, reaching it on August 29th. The Dutch welcomed the French vessel, helping them obtain provisions and supplies. The French would spend 6 days on Java, with Derville often visiting the Chinese quarter of the town. All of his life he would be fascinated by China. The Coquille entered the Indian Ocean on October 3rd and made for Mauritius, an island just east of Madagascar. The island, despite being ruled by the British, was almost all French. There, Derville met Charles Telfair, a Belfast-born naturalist and doctor. Telfair would show off the island's famous botanical gardens, and the two would form a lasting friendship. After resupplying, the expedition stopped at the nearby island of Bourbon and then headed south to round the Cape of Good Hope, the southern tip of Africa. The Coquille did not stop at any of the colonies along the coast, as they were well supplied at this point. The rounding of the Cape went well, and then it was north. They reached the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic on January 2, 1825. The desolate island is, to this day, famous as the last home of Napoleon Bonaparte, who had been exiled there after his defeat in 1815. He had died just 3 years earlier. Derville and some of the other officers would visit the emperor's grave, as well as his home, which Derville said was in a ramshackle state. Derville was not in the least a Bonapartist, and he disliked much of what the man had done, but he also recognized and respected the achievements of Napoleon and the spell that he'd woven over France and Europe. The Coquille headed north, departing on January 11, 1825. There was a brief stop at Ascension Island a week later, and then onward. The ship passed through the Strait of Gibraltar on March 9th. 2 weeks later, they reached Marseille. The voyage of the Coquille was over. Now, this should have been a time to rejoice and celebrate a successful voyage, and it was for many, but not for Derville. It was on his return that he found out that his son, Jules, had died 2 years earlier, and his wife, Adelaide, had fallen into a debilitating depression from which she had not emerged. While Derville could only mourn for so long, he was soon sent to Paris, where he had to help get the results of the expedition in order. It was not an easy task. He was disappointed that he was not promoted immediately to the rank of captain. Duperrey would get that promotion in May. But there were commendations for Derville. In June, he was named a Chevalier de St. Louis in recognition of his outstanding military service. It came with a pension, which was always nice. As for his promotion, that would come a few months later. Derville was now a captain in the French Navy. Regarding Derville's family, he would bring Adelaide to Paris so they could be together. In time, she was pregnant again, and the prospect of another child helped her recover her health. A son would soon follow, who would be named Jules, just like the first, but now deceased, son. Regarding the Coquille expedition, Derville and his team brought back a trove of stuff. This included more than 3,000 specimens of plants, 400 of which were unknown to science. And there were hundreds of other items, including animal and geological samples. And there was the ethnological information Derville had collected. And I want to stress this was just what Derville had done. The expedition had done a bunch of other work regarding astronomy, magnetism, cartography, and much, much more. The organization and publication of everything done by the Coquille would take 5 years. There were botanical, zoological, and hydrographic volumes and atlases. Derville was the key person on the botanical work. Regarding Derville's work, scientists, even people who were not necessarily fans of Derville, praised the results. Celebrated physicist and astronomer Francois Arago said Derville was, quote, not content to gather plants offered to view. He had analyzed and described them with care, end quote. This was all done exceptionally well, Arago noted, despite Derville's duties as second-in-command of the expedition. Now, one thing that did not happen quickly was the history of the expedition. This was something Duperrey, as the commander, had dibs on, and while he insisted he was going to do it, he never did. He started it, but around 1830, he stopped work on the project and never picked it up again. Derville would finally get out his version of the voyage in 1834 and 1835 with the publication of, forgive me for this pronunciation, Voyage Piscardesque Autour du Monde, or Scenic Voyage Around the World. René Lesson published his own two-volume history of the expedition in 1838 and 1839. Now, all the stuff going on made everyone very busy, but that did not stop Derville from plotting out the future. Even before returning to Europe, the idea of a new expedition, led by himself, had been rolling around his head. And thus, on May 23, 1825, just 2 months after returning to France, he sent a proposal to the Naval Ministry for a new expedition. The idea was to follow up on the unfinished work of the Coquille. He said there were too many poorly determined locations and no complete exploration of much of the area, save for the Gilbert and Mulgrave Islands. It was one of those, hey, my boss did a nice job, but I can do a better one sort of letters. And a big thing that Duperrey had not done was something they really wanted, a survey of the Swan River area of Western Australia. The idea of a penal colony there, or New Zealand, was a hot topic. And so, in September of that year, Derville would get preliminary approval for his own expedition. On December 4th, the expedition details were sent to the king for royal approval. Within days, the ball was rolling. Derville's expedition was now a reality. The one thing I want to mention before finishing today is the ship assigned to the voyage. It was the Coquille. She was ordered refitted and improved based upon the experiences of the previous voyage. But a major difference was, in reality, superficial. And that would be a name change. Going forward, the ship's moniker would be the Astrolabe. This was done to differentiate the ship from the previous expedition. Also, it was the name of one of the ships of French explorer Jean-François Le Perouse, whose two ships had disappeared in the South Pacific in 1788, and whose fate had been a long-standing question mark for the French public. Regarding Le Perouse, Derville will go searching for and discover the fate of the famed mariner, but that is for a future episode in this series. So that is it for today. Jules Dumont d'Urville had returned to Europe successfully, but now he was set to return to the far corners of the globe, this time in command of his own expedition. Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Join us next time when we continue this series. Thanks for listening. The Explorers Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Network. Go to airwavemedia.com to find other great shows, including History That Doesn't Suck and American Carnage.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Have you ever gazed in wonder at the Great Pyramid? Have you marveled at the golden face of Tutankhamun? Or admired the delicate features of Queen Nefertiti? If you have, you'll probably like the History of Egypt podcast. Every week, we explore tales of this ancient culture. The History of Egypt is available wherever you get your podcasting fix. Come, let me introduce you to the world of ancient Egypt.